Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Hercules and the Space Gods. I am Hercules Invictus. Hercules and the Space Gods is a voyage of discovery that is currently unfolding through a podcast on Mount Olympus and CERN, select chapters in Tim Beckley's paranormal anthologies, a variety of live and now Zoom events, and several articles published in various magazines over the past few years. Hercules and the Space Gods supports all of humanity's efforts to transcend this world and venture forth into the great beyond, be they metaphysical, mechanical, or even imaginal. And today we're going to enter the imaginal realms of retro sci-fi and horror cinema. But before we start, I have a quick review to give of Hercules in Marvel Comics, the original miniseries. The associations between the stories of Olympian mythology and the patterns in the night sky are hoary with age. It is to our credit that millennia later we still honor the tales immortalized in the starry sky by our ancestors and continue to add new ones of our own devising. Hercules is banished from Mount Olympus and is bound to travel the vastness of space until such a time as he can learn humility. So decreed the red-haired Zeus in the Marvel Universe back in the 1980s. And thus began a comedic epic that spanned the decades, courtesy of Bob Layton's cosmic creativity. Driving the sun chariot of Apollo, the Prince of Power went forth into the starry void. In the dawn of his odyssey, the colonizers of Rigel supplied him with a recorder to chronicle his myriad adventures. And what adventures they were. Naught was as it seemed, and many a life lesson did the son of Zeus learn. Though he often found himself in trouble, his heroic spirit finally triumphed over all internal and external obstacles. Using a ploy as ancient as Elos, he even saved the planet from destruction by making the world eater Galactus laugh over a shared drink. The years pass quickly for our star-spanning hero. Many a tale is sung throughout the cosmos regarding his many astral exploits and bedroom conquests. It is now 2385 CE. Hercules, still accompanied by the robotic recorder, makes friends with a roguish Shrull, gives his heart to a mortal woman, and starts to age prematurely. With the help of Mentor, ruler of Titan and staunch ally of Zeus, he discovers that all is not well on Mount Olympus. Zeus, in a fit of madness, has slain his kin and has laid waste to his shining kingdom. Though initially reluctant to fight his father, Hercules eventually challenges the Lord of Dark Clouds and triumphs. Before Zeus dies, he expresses his love for his son and explains that the time has come for Olympians to finally leave the mortal sphere behind. Hercules is the last of the Olympians. And although the adventure seemed to stall there for quite a while, Bob Layton picked it up and continued it. And now onwards to retro sci-fi and horror cinema with Brian Walker of Brian's Drive-In Theater. Greetings and welcome, Brian. How are you?
I'm well tonight, Hercules. Much better than last week. How are you doing?
I'm glad to hear that. Okay, some technical difficulties. I had to call in with my phone to get the show started, but such is the information age.
That's okay. We can overcome that pretty quickly.
I am very interested to hear your unpopular opinions today.
Yeah, you know, I spend 99% of my time, building up films. But tonight I thought it would be interesting to sort of turn the tables and talk about some science fiction and horror films that I'm not crazy about. And these are the ones I want to talk about tonight are actually very well reviewed, much loved by a lot of people. I think in going through IMDb's ratings, and I know that that's not gospel or anything, but it is kind of a litmus test on how popular a film is, across across the world, really. It's not just America, certainly. I've been watching movies my whole life. I'm 55 years old now, and I've fallen, prey to summer blockbuster hype, just like anybody else. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk about tonight, were some of the sci-fi summer blockbusters over the years. And these are retro at this point. You know, some of these movies are between, let's say, 25 and 44 years old at this point, at least the ones that I want to talk about tonight. And, you know, if we have time, or maybe it may go over to next month, I'd like to talk about some films, science fiction and horror films, that I believe to be underrated, you know, that I think should have, you know, maybe more presence, more people should have seen them.
That sounds like an excellent topic, and you have a choice. You're on next Tuesday for 20-25 minutes on the Ron Carson's Coliseum. It was your turn, so, and then you have next month a couple of shows, so we could definitely cover that in a very short period of time.
Oh, I'm sure we can. And if you're ready to get started, I'll probably spin my tail. All of my friends have heard, my experience of watching E.T., the extraterrestrial. I saw E.T., which came out in 1982, and it was the summer blockbuster for 1982. I think I was probably about 16 years old when the movie came out. And, you know, I mean, at that age, you go see every summer blockbuster.
Right.
And I have since, summer blockbusters really started. You can argue this point, but it seems to me that Jaws sort of kicked off that whole summer blockbuster event. I can remember my father going to buy tickets so that our family could see Jaws. But the movie was so popular, and if you remember, I mean, this was more than 45 years ago, you didn't have many megaplexes back then as you do now, that is. Well, or I think did, I either to put it, unfortunately. You still had a lot of standalone theaters, which are rare, these days. But when I was a kid, and I'm sure that holds true for you as well, your local town might have had like four or five standalone theaters downtown. When I was a kid, one of our downtown theaters, which just had one screen, that was the one that was selected to run Jaws. And you had to buy tickets in advance, and you sort of had to – it was the first and I think one of the only times that I actually had to – that I was actually expected to schedule watching a film. And I loved Jaws. I still love it. I think it's a fantastic movie. A few years ago, Fathom Events ran Jaws again in theaters, and my partner and I went to see it. And I got to tell you, it was as exciting seeing it through the Fathom event from a few years ago as it was when I was like 10 years old in 1975. Seeing it at my local I wouldn't call it a grindhouse, but it was an older theater. I think it was built in the 1930s or so. And I loved that movie. And since it sort of kicked off that whole summer blockbuster thing, I made it a point to go see, every summer blockbuster that came out. I believe the next year, The Omen, which is a horror film, was a summer blockbuster. Star Wars, for 1977. Blockbuster. It was by saying blockbuster, I mean it's the movie that you're sort of expected to go see. It's the big picture, usually the one with the biggest budget or a large budget that is supposed to appeal to a wide slice of the audience, and oftentimes they do. Close Encounters of the Third Kind, that was also kind of a big picture that you were supposed to see. And by 1982, E.T., that was the big summer movie. And I got to tell you, even as a 16-year-old, I sat there and watched the movie. I saw it three times that summer. And it's not because I liked it. I wasn't hate watching it. So, and I don't really believe in that.
I think that's silly to watch something so you can hate it. But I wound up, for whatever reason, watching this film three times that summer at various theaters, you know, where I was growing up. And I think the first time I went to see it with some friends. The second time, my mom wanted to go see it, so I took her to see it. And it's one of her favorite films, so she wanted to go see it again that summer. And I begrudgingly went with her. And I have to tell you, I know it's a beloved film. I know it's sort of a family classic. And it is a science fiction film, although...
In a way, yeah.
It has more elements than that. But it's probably the science fiction film that I hate the most. It sort of took an alien invasion, which used to be... the crux of a science fiction film. It was the horror in a science fiction film. And it took this alien invasion and made it cute and heartwarming. And I didn't appreciate that. And I don't think I still do. I want aliens to be the other. It's not that I want them to be, you know, hated or anything like that. But I just didn't like the way they went about and the product placement in it. That was kind of fresh and new to me. You know, I'm sure I had seen it in other films because E.T. did not invent product placement in films.
No.
But I think it did succeed in going incredibly overboard with product placement. From the Reese's Pieces, which was a new, you know, that's kind of an old candy at this point if you talk to college students. But back then, that was a very new candy, and it was sort of an alternative to M&M's or, you know, something like that. And I really didn't like all of the different product placement in it. It made, for me, even for my 16-year-old self, a lot of it read as a Saturday morning cartoon. And the commercials that you would see, you know, between cartoon segments, because the product placement just slapped you in the face so hard. And it just wasn't something that I really liked. And it kind of it kind of reeked as being produced by a committee. It seems to me that that film was it. Well, it does, and I think that kills art when you've got, you know, 50 people and they're all holding the purse strings. And I realize that everything is made to a price. You know, I'm not a Pollyanna here. But the movie just seemed to be made for marketing. It seemed to be there. You know, they even made the alien cute. And if you do research on it, they modeled E.T.'s face after that of a Himalayan cat. Believe it or not, at that time, yes, and at that time, believe it or not, my family had a Himalayan cat. they were well. I mean, he was a very handsome cat, very smart, a lot of fun, and I guess they wanted to make the alien cute. You know, in endearing, you know, certainly non-threatening. Maybe that's the best route to take with that. But I think they went overboard with it a little bit and made it maybe a little too cute, maybe a little too easily digestible for, you know, kids to see. And I just think that the whole child angle on E.T. kind of ruins it for me. It just sort of takes over. Now there are some good things that I would say about this film as well, and all of them. It certainly, you know, summer blockbusters, even in 1982, you know, that was still an emerging thing, and that movie was a huge blockbuster. I think in the town that I was living in at that time, I think that movie played for a solid year at one of the theaters in town.
Wow.
You know, it was
Star
that
Wars
big.
It was that
popular. Yes, it was. You could see Star Wars at any time that you wanted to see it for about a year and a half in the late 70s.
Yeah.
And that was before it was ever released to home video. And I guess the best thing that I can say about E.T. is that I don't want to say that it legitimizes science fiction, you know, as a genre that can compete, you know, with drama and, you know, rom-coms and things like that. I don't want to say that, because I think that had already been done by Star Wars, you know, quite honestly. But it did establish science fiction as one of the genre that you do see in summer blockbusters. And then there's a lot of them, you know, overall. So those are the good things
that I can say
about E.T. And I don't – have you ever been to Universal Studios in Florida?
No, I have not. I've been to Florida and I've been to California, but I haven't had a chance to go to Disney or to Universal Studios.
Well, the Universal Studios in Florida, and this ride does not appear at the Universal Studios there in Hollywood, which is actually Burbank. But the Universal Studios in Florida, now I haven't been there for several years. I'm going to assume that E.T., the ride, is still there. Now, I could be mistaken about that. But the ride itself at Universal, I actually do like, although it is kind of hokey. So I guess there is something about the movie that is just so endearing that we're all a little helpless or hopeless, you know, when it comes to it, because I do enjoy that ride, you know, quite a bit. And you know, seeing E.T. in it doesn't really bother me so much. But I didn't care for the product placement at all. I didn't care for the plot. The actors in it are good, especially the kids, you know, and the kids have to, you know, Drew Barrymore's in it, you know, as a small child, and you know, the children, the child actors in it have to kind of carry the lion's share of the drama in it. That couldn't have been easy to pull that performance out of those kids. And that's probably another area where that film is really successful.
It's interesting
maybe
you talk about the commercialism because the game E.T. was one of the things for the Atari was one of the things that's credited with killing the video game industry. It was just so terrible. Yeah, it was definitely to capitalize on the popularity of the film, but the game was so terrible that it was one of the contributing factors to video games dying out for a little while.
And, you know, I had an Atari 2600 as a teenager, and when I was doing research for our podcast tonight, I stumbled upon that Atari E.T. game, and I got to tell you, I don't ever recall seeing one. I know I never played it. I just didn't remember that coming out. But you know, by that time, you know, I was becoming an adult, and video games were it was different back then because I associated video games as being for children at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as I passed into adulthood, I, you know, consciously wanted to leave, you know, childhood behind. And maybe, you know, that's where my attitude about video games comes from. I realize that now, you know, there are lots of adults who are way into video games. And that just didn't happen for me. And that's fine. You know, I have enough to focus on.
Yes, you do.
I don't need a habit like video games on top of it. I really don't. Maybe it's something to look forward to when I retire. But that's sort of my spiel on E.T. I don't like that. I really hate that movie to this day. It is just not a film that I ever care to see again. I don't understand why it was so popular. The marketing around it got to me after a while because, you know, E.T.'s face was on everything. And that kind of leads me to the next film that I thought was incredibly overrated. Now, this one I think has had longer legs than E.T. E.T. seems to be a film that is still stuck back there in the early 80s. You know, I don't think it has weathered the passage of time the way some other films have. Ghostbusters, which was just 2 years later, and that was the 1984 summer blockbuster, I think it has actually lasted a lot longer. And, you know, there was a sequel to it, you know, just a few years ago that was made. And, you know, as a newly minted adult, I was excited after my freshman year in college to come home and, you know, go see Ghostbusters at the mall. And I sat there for 2 hours and hated it. It still stands out as one of the worst A pictures I have ever seen. The sad thing about it is that there's so many elements about it that I should love. Harold Ramis wrote the lion's share of the screenplay, and I think you and I are both Second City fans, right?
Yes.
I think some of the people who have come out of Second City are some of the funniest people, you know, from the late 20th century. And Harold Ramis was one of them. I loved him, you know, in the early days of SCTV, you know, Second City Television, back in the late 70s. I thought he was brilliant. He was a great writer, and I don't know why this movie is so bad, for me at least. Probably the worst thing for me about this movie is Bill Murray's performance in it. He mugs at the camera. He mugs at the camera the way that silent comedians in the 1920s might have done, especially the ones who weren't so funny. His line delivery is horrible. Bill Murray is another person that, you know, I grew up loving. When I was watching Saturday Night Live as a young teenager, I loved Bill Murray. I thought he was hilarious. He was one of the reasons I wanted to see the movie, because he was one of the stars of it, along with Dan Aykroyd and several others. It was an expensive movie as well. I mean, back then, Ghostbusters is now, 37 years old. It was a $30 million movie back then. That was very expensive.
That's
it
a
had
lot
big name stars.
Then,
Oh, yeah. And the special effects were horrible. I mean, even for 1984, as I was watching it on screen, I thought, gosh, you know, couldn't we do better than this? it almost reads like a 3D movie, but you're watching it in 2D. Almost as if you forgot to pick up the red and blue lensed 3D glasses, you know, when you walked into the theater, and the ghosts just look kind of flat. There again, not a movie that I cared for at all. And maybe the worst part of it, other than Bill Murray's performance, which, honest to God, it's terrible, is that awful theme song, Ray Parker Jr., the Ghostbusters theme song. It might have had six words in it. You know, the song doesn't go anywhere. It was immensely popular that summer. You heard it everywhere.
Yes, I remember. It was popular for years. Even now, people like parody it, or, you know, it's a very recognizable song.
Oh, it sure is. And I mean, incredibly popular. Somebody made some money off that song and off this movie. But that doesn't mean I have to like it. And the movie seems, and you know, worse than, more so than E.T., I think Ghostbusters was kind of, it almost seems like it was made as a marketing scheme. You said, well, we want to sell cereal and lunch boxes
and toys,
you know, toys and action figures and crap to kids. So let's figure out what we're going to sell them, and then we'll build a movie around it. It almost seems like it was done in reverse. And it's such a shame, because when I was doing prep for tonight's show, I went back through and looked at the cast for Ghostbusters, and I was just kind of blown away. I mean, there's a listing of about 20 people there who are who I consider to be immensely talented. I mean, there's not anybody there who doesn't have a great deal of talent and comedic timing. But it just doesn't come together in that movie for me. I actually watched the sequel, and I found it even worse, even more appalling than the original
Yes, the sequel wasn't as good as the original. And then they made a remake, as you pointed out before, recently, a couple of years ago, and that didn't do very well.
It didn't. But I really can't comment on it. I liked the fact that they wanted to do an all-female remake of it. I thought that was sharp, smart, clever. Brings something different to it. You know, it freshens it. But I didn't see it, so I can't really comment on the new one.
I haven't seen it either. There was a lot of controversy around the film, too. Because there had been an earlier show with Larry Storch called Ghostbusters. And I think they had a gorilla with Larry Storch and some other people. And then there were cartoons of both Ghostbusters, the one with Bill Murray and Harold Ramisson, and then the other Ghostbusters. And I think one of them called themselves the real Ghostbusters. It became kind of messy. And then there were endless toys, I remember, and Halloween costumes.
Yeah. Oh, it weren't there. I still stand by my statement as saying that when they decided to remake Ghostbusters, and I'm not a remake fan. I was willing to give it a shot on this movie because I could see where if this movie were redone, if it were recast, that it could be something that I would love. And I was impressed that they wanted to do the all-female cast, and I thought, well, gosh, this is something I could get behind. Maybe if it's redone, and maybe if the script is better, quite honestly, I thought maybe I can get behind this. But I just never got around to watching it. And that's not to say that I don't, as a rule, think that remakes are terrible. Because, sometimes you do need to add – you do need to bring a movie, into contemporary times with contemporary mores, especially if the story is that good. If the story is universal, I think it's easier to do a remake. And with Ghostbusters, I just never saw it. I never saw the remake, so which is a shame because I really can't comment on it. But the original PU, for me, I know there are people who love that film, and
well, there's a
more power.
You have a relationship with the films that you watch. Like I remember when the first Conan film came out with Arnold Schwarzenegger. It was a good movie, but I didn't like it because I was a Conan fan, and I'd been waiting for this movie to come out for like 10 years. They were talking about it, and Schwarzenegger was involved from the beginning, but it took like a decade for them to finally make it. And basically the movie seemed to me to be like a collection of covers from the comic book and the paperbacks that they kind of set those in to the story so that you could recognize like Easter eggs. Then from all the original writings on Conan or the comic books, they made like a lot of deviations from the story. So I thought, why not just not call it Conan? Why not make up your own barbarian and call it that? But then I started liking the movie because of it was a good movie. So I liked the movie despite the issues that I had with it. And then not too long ago, Jason Momoa played Conan. And again, I'm a Conan fan. So there was nothing wrong with Jason Momoa's performance. He made an excellent Conan as far as I was concerned. And Rose McGowan made an excellent, witch. And it was okay, but they skipped from place to place. So like one, if you were familiar with the Hyborian Age, like 1 minute you're in China and then 3 minutes later you're in Ireland. You know, that's how jarring it was if you're familiar with the stories. You know, they just teleported like they did on Game of Thrones in the last couple of seasons where they'd be in one place, then they'd be someplace else that took months to get to. So again, I liked Momoa's performance. As a sword and sandal film or a sword and sorcery film, it wasn't that bad, but it's going to take me a while to get to like that too, I guess.
Well, and you bring up a really important point there. The anticipation of it, you know, if you've got high hopes, you know, for a film or any kind of piece of art that you're intending on appreciating, if you've got high expectations for it, it's going to be easier for you to find fault with it, quite honestly, you know,
right,
because
right.
you're already at 100. So, and you want this film, you know, to be everything you want it to be. And it's going to be easy to be a little disappointed in a film like that. And I think for me, that's where, you know, Ghostbusters really let me down. Like I said, huge Harold Ramis fan. I had been my whole life, you know, really. You know, Dan Aykroyd, I mean, I loved Saturday Night Live, and there were, you know, several players there from Saturday Night Live in it, and they just let me down.
Yeah.
And I expected it to be just uproariously funny, and I found that, you know, and I was not a sophisticated audience member at that age. You know, I was not watching it for anything other than just pure entertainment and escapism for 2 hours. And it didn't deliver that for me. I remembered sitting there, and I was with some friends when I went to see it. And I remembered sitting there thinking, you know, if they weren't with me, I'd walk out of here. You know, I just didn't want to see the rest of the film. And it's so much easier now to sort of walk away from a movie.
Yes.
I saw a lot of movies in the theater that I didn't really care for, you know, and oftentimes they were these big blockbusters, but you paid your dollar or whatever it was, and you had your popcorn in hand. So you were going to stick it out because you went out to see it, you were there, and you went ahead and watched it. These days, you know, if I'm watching, you know, if I'm at home, you know, watching something, and I don't like it, well, I can go to, you know, a different streaming service and watch something else.
Yes.
Or if it is physical media, I can hit the eject button, which I know I've done numerous times on other movies. It's not science fiction, but I never could make it more than 30 minutes into The Hangover.
Into the which one? I'm sorry.
Into The Hangover.
Okay, I never saw that.
Okay, it's a comedy from about 10 or 12 years ago. It's Bradley Cooper and Zach Galifianakis. Ed Helms.
You know, I never saw it.
Really? Oh, okay, well, don't, because it's a terrible movie.
You make
some
a
friends
good
of
point,
ours,
though.
Go ahead.
Oh, you make a good point, because I used to love bad movies. I used to watch every movie till its end, you know, even if it was bad, because, you know, it was a movie, somebody made it, you know, I figured it's here, I'll watch it. But now as I get older, too, and, you know, the time ahead of me is less than the time behind me, it's kind of like, you know, I give things 20 minutes to draw me in. And if they haven't joined me in 20 minutes, just, you know, I'm not going to give it any more time. So I find myself doing that as well.
Well, and we do have really short attention spans now. And I'm very conflicted about that. And I'm as guilty of that as anyone. You know, having a short attention span wasn't born with millennials or Gen Z.
No.
It goes back farther than that. But a lot of it now is just the way we watch films. You know, I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. It's not the collective experience. It's not the communal experience that we once had. And it is easier just to walk away from it. And like I said, I'm as guilty of that as anybody else. But, you know, if a movie really should reach out and grab you during that first opening sequence, you know, and I'm going to talk about, just because we've gotten there, I'm going to talk about a movie that didn't cost very much but was a blockbuster. I don't know if you're a fan of the Friday the 13th franchise at all.
I've seen more than a handful of them, yes.
Okay. I like the franchise quite a bit. I think the first three films were pretty good. And I remember seeing the original when I was a teenager, the original Friday the 13th. It was shot in your neck of the woods, New Jersey. In the fall of 1979. It was shot really quickly. I think the shoot was about 3.5 weeks or so. That's fast, you know, for a big film.
Yes.
It was only shot for about $500,000, and while that was more than 40 years ago, $500,000 in the late 70s to make a film, not a whole lot of money, you know, especially for, you know, the number of cast members that there were, and that it was shot largely, you know, not on a sound stage where you can control the atmosphere, but it was shot, you know, at a real, you know, summer camp, where it had to have been harder to do setups and things like that. But that movie, the first sequence, you know, the first scene in the movie appears before the title, and it reaches out and grabs you. I mean, something happens almost immediately in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it does reach out and grab you, and it does draw you in immediately, and you want to watch more of it and try to figure it out, to figure out what happened to this poor woman and who did this to her. It really does suck you in, and it made huge box office for that minimal investment. And maybe one of the things that I like about it best is I always watch who's in the cast. And, you know, that movie did have an up-and-coming star. You know, Kevin Bacon is in the film. He has a pretty sizable role in Friday the 13th. And, you know, he went on to do, you know, so much more. But the person I wanted to talk about a little bit is the antagonist in the movie, who's Betsy Palmer. You know, she is Jason Voorhees' mother in Friday the 13th.
Yes, I remember.
And had been an actress for a long time. She was in some movies in the 1950s, and, you know, when she married and had to, you know, leave Hollywood and return to New York, she did a lot of game shows. She was on TV quite a bit. By the time that, you know, the 1980s rolled around, you know, she was an actress who was kind of down on her luck. She was in her early 50s. She'd gotten divorced from her husband, who was a physician. She was having some cash flow problems, and she needed a new car. You know, her car was dying. She had like a 9 or a 10-year-old car. And, you know, back then cars weren't as reliable, you know, as they are now, you know, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And she was offered $10,000 to do the role of Mrs. Voorhees in Friday the 13th. And she didn't want to do a horror film, but she really needed that new car. And she did the movie for the 10 grand. And you know, she, as soon as she got paid, she went out and bought a 1980 Volkswagen Scirocco. She thought that movie was going to go away. She never dreamed that it would appear in theaters for more than a week. And as it turns out, it was a massive blockbuster. Unfortunately, and I think this is a shame. I think she was a little saddened by that, maybe a little ashamed by it, and didn't really enjoy the notoriety. Initially, I don't think she enjoyed that notoriety so much. It did help get her career going again. She did start,
which is great,
you know, appearing. Yeah, you know, true. And she did start appearing in TV roles again. It did help it did help her some, you know. But it's a shame that she was ashamed of the film, because I think she's fantastic in it. She at one time she seems honest and genuine, that she wants to help the camper, and on the other hand she plays Twisted really well. She plays that psychotic role. I think she does a great job with it. And I know she was doing it just so that she'd have something to drive. I think that, kind of is testament to her talent. I think she was way more talented than she ever really got to display, in a lot of roles. And I am the proud owner of an 8x10 of her. It's a black and white 1950s. Shot of her. Now, she signed it in 2004. It wasn't original to the 50s. The shot's from the 50s, though. And by then, I think she had, her attitude had softened quite a bit about her role in Friday the 13th, and I think she was able to enjoy it at the time that she signed, the photo that I have. It's just a shame that initially she couldn't have, maybe exploited is not the word, but maybe it's a shame that she couldn't have enjoyed the ride a little more,
Yeah, that is a shame.
Maybe it is, because it took her out of being career in the doldrums and being a nobody, and it made her somebody again. It introduced her to kind of a new audience. I knew who she was because, it's kind of me. She'd been on TV and she'd been in movies. I mean, I knew who Betsy Palmer was pretty well. But a lot of people probably didn't. And I thought she did a great job in it. And I think that is a – Friday the 13th is sort of a textbook definition of a low-budget horror movie that becomes a blockbuster on its own, makes millions of dollars, and I kind of like a success story, And I'm
sure
I don't really recall my attitude going to see it initially, as a 15-year-old. I think I was excited that it was a horror film, and I was kind of blown away by it. But I'm not really sure that I had big expectations for it. I think I was thinking, this is another horror film, but I'm excited to see it.
And I had the same
with blockbusters. With blockbusters, you expect something big. You expect great visuals, terrific performances, an engaging script. You expect to be drawn in from the very beginning, and the movie holds on to you, for an entire 2-hour period until the end of it. And if a blockbuster doesn't do that, even though they've had almost infinite resources in producing this film, it's just such a disappointment.
Oh, most certainly so.
And another. Another unpopular opinion of mine is Independence Day, which is about 25 years
Independence
old
Day. Yes, I was just thinking Independence Day, so I'm glad you brought that up.
Well, and when I was coming up with my outline for this evening, I don't know why, but I was thinking that Independence Day was a fairly new movie. In comparison to Ghostbusters and E.T. And when I looked at, the release date, I thought, I can't believe this is 25 years old. I just can't believe it, but it is. And it's another movie that I was horribly disappointed in. And there again, I had high expectations. If you look at the cast list for Independence Day, it is amazing. That is one fantastic cast. I mean, Will Smith, Bill Pullman, who he's good at drama, he's good at comedy. Same goes for Jeff Goldblum. You know, and Judd Hirsch, I mean, what a great actor. Robert Loggia. Randy Quaid, who does comedy well. He did comedy so well until he went off the rails. Harvey Firestein, who also, you know, is really adept at drama and comedy. It's got a fantastic cast, and I loathe that movie. It's so low camp. I mean, it's just a mess. I wanted to love it, and it just didn't deliver to me on any level.
Same here. I was totally disappointed, and I had high expectations for that, you know, from the commercials as well, and it just disappointed me. I didn't even see the remake that they did not too long ago.
I didn't either, and you know, the terrible thing is that I didn't know they had done a remake, excuse me, until I was doing research for this. When I saw that, I thought, oh my God, this was remade. Why would you do it? I just don't know. And it's another movie that, you know, I'm not sure has had legs. For whatever reason, you know, some movies will span decades and be every bit as fresh and popular as they were. Star Wars is the best example of that.
Yeah.
Big summer. Yeah, it was the big summer blockbuster from 1977. I saw it as a 12-year-old.
I was graduating high school when it came out, and I saw it endlessly. I don't know how many times I saw it, but I saw it a lot during the year and a half that it was there to see.
Well, you know, a piece of useless trivia here. Own a rare Super 8mm digest version of the film of Star Wars.
Oh, wow.
They brought it out. Yeah, they brought that digest out months after the movie came out. And that was pretty rare for Super 8. Usually for the home video market back then, you were seeing, you know, movies that were 10, 15, 20 years old, you know, in digest form. But this is a 200-foot Super 8mm digest version. It's about 7 minutes or so, and it's just sort of edited sequences of the movie. And since it is just 7 minutes out of a movie that's about 2 hours, you know, you don't get a whole lot of the film. Although you could buy digest versions that lasted longer, but this one is rare because. when you bought Super 8mm films, oftentimes, especially if you bought them at a department store or something like that, it was a black and white silent version of it. and it was black and white because that saved, you know, a few pennies. And it was silent because that saved a lot of pennies. but the version that I have is sound. So it does have sound, but it was done in black and white, and it's an oddity, because most of the versions, and I looked at eBay today to see if I could see a black and white version of it that also was sound, and I couldn't find one. I have found them in the past. And I mean, when I say that it's rare, I mean, it does have some value, but it's not like I'm going to be able to retire off of it, you know, if I sell it. But for a Super 8mm film that's got some age on it, you know, 40 plus years old, it's probably worth about $80 or $90, which is amazing, you know, considering most Super 8 isn't worth more than $10. You know, you don't really nobody's collecting it these days for the most part. I still have my own collection of Super 8mm that I had. You know, as a teenager, I haven't gotten rid of anything, primarily because I don't think anybody wants what I've got. So I'm just going to hang on to it until the bitter end. But that is kind of one of the rare gems in my Super 8mm collection, is that black and white sound version of Star Wars. And when I haven't watched it for a long, long time. the digest version that I have. But the black and white is, it almost makes it, it gives it almost a serial look, you know, like the old serials from the 30s, 40s, and the early 50s. It gives it that kind of look. And it's kind of based on those old Western and science fiction serials. And I think that's where a lot of the meter for the script comes from, you know, really. You know, the cast for Star Wars is excellent. The sets are awesome, and some of the visuals are just amazing. And you know, a science fiction film really needs those visuals, maybe more so than any other genre. You know, in a horror film, you can get away with not lighting a scene. You know, you can get away with, you know, having a minimal set or you know, something of that nature in a horror film. But in a science fiction film, that set had better look good. You know, everything in the background, you know, needs to contribute to, you know, the fantasy of the future or space or whatever is being explored, you know, in that science fiction film. And that's probably where Star Wars, you know, really excels, is just the look, you know, of it. And
yeah,
you
it was very
like
unique and original at the time.
Yes, it very. And like the movie or not, there are some sort of cultural touchstones that are associated with the film. The bar scene in the original Star Wars film is something that I use that description probably once a month to describe a situation that I've encountered or maybe a restaurant that I've been in, you know, or a bar or something of that nature. It is a good descriptor, or it can be, that is. The script is pretty well done. The cast is there again. You know, the cast for the film is excellent, and they really sell it. You know, if it had had a lesser cast, if the cast hadn't been as talented, or they didn't have the charisma on screen as much as these actors did, I think it could have easily bombed. Because they did go out on a limb. For Star Wars. I mean, that is yes, they had a lot of money to spend on it, but they took, kind of a chance on some actors who weren't all that well known at the time. You know, Mark Hamill, Carrie Fisher, who was just 19 years old, you know, and had only done, you know, very limited things before. Harrison Ford was about to give up as an actor, and he'd been a, you know, journeyman actor for about 15 years before that movie was made. And you can see him in, you know, a lot of guest spots in like 60s and 70s TV shows, you know, a movie or two here or there. He's in American Graffiti, for example.
Yes.
One of my favorite films, actually. That's probably in my top 25 or 30 films. One of the ways I started preparing for, you know, tonight's podcast was coming up with a list of my favorite films. And after about 50 or so, I stopped because it wasn't really getting me anywhere. But I am going to pursue that.
Good. And we only have 5 more minutes. So, yeah, I was going to say a list of 50. Maybe we can do the first two or three today.
It'd be kind of hard to do today, especially since I'm talking about movies that I wasn't all that crazy about.
Right.
You know, and Jurassic Park is another one of those summer blockbusters that I went to see. That came out in 1993, and so wanted to love it for several reasons. One of them is that it dealt with dinosaurs, and I thought, wow, you know, I really like the premise of this movie. And you know, the premise for a movie, you know, if it's engaging enough, and you know, if it strikes your fancy, it's going to make you come into the megaplex and watch it. And as a child, there was a, I guess, an amusement park of sorts that my mom took me to. It was called, I think it was called Domke's Gardens, and it was dinosaur themed. And this is well before, you know, Jurassic Park. You know, this thing was built in the late 1950s, and it has life-size representations of different varieties of dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
It is still there. I went back to see it 4 years ago, kind of on a journey to, you know, capture my youth from long ago. I was so excited to see that it was still there and still operating. It has a different name now. It's called Dinosaur Gardens, and it's out in the middle of nowhere in Ossining, Michigan. But it is a sight to see. I took my partner to see it, and I think he was sort of dumbfounded by it, because there's one dinosaur that has these steps that you walk up into, and you know, she's life size. So
inside the dinosaur,
kind of,
or?
Yes, yeah, yes.
Oh wow!
You know, some dinosaurs were huge. I mean, big enough to walk into. Now she's sort of a non-threatening dinosaur, but some of the raptors and things like that that they have represented there are kind of chilling, you know, with teeth, and you know, some of the carnivores are at Dinosaur Gardens are pretty scary. Anyway, that kind of, remembering that as a child, that really set the stage for me for Jurassic Park, and I was really excited to see it because I wanted to see these dinosaurs, you know, actually moving. You know, moving around, and I wanted to see how they did it. And the special effects are great in Jurassic Park, but I hated the script. I thought the script was kind of dumb. I loved Sir Richard Attenborough in it, but to tell you the truth, before I went into IMDb to look at the cast list, he was the only person I could remember being in it. I couldn't remember who the other cast members were, and that's a bad sign.
that's a very bad sign, especially since you look for that in movies.
Right.
And
right.
We're going to have to close. We have 2 minutes left, and I'd like for you to give your information. But I really enjoyed the conversation. I totally lost track of time, so I just looked at the clock. It's like, ah.
Well, you know, that happens to us every month.
Yes,
anyway,
very true.
If you'd like to get into my head a little bit more about, you know, my likes and dislikes when it comes to celluloid, you can always go to my website, Brian's Drive-In Theater. That's Brian with an I, and it's briansdriveintheater.com. Any of the search engines, Bing, Yahoo, Google, can get you to me. And if you want to do some more interaction with me, you can always see what the movie of the day is going to be if you go to Facebook. And all you have to do is go to Facebook.com, and then in the search box type in Brian's Drive-In Theater, and you will find me.
That is incredibly awesome. Thanks again, Brian. You made me laugh several times and brought back memories of old movies I hadn't thought about in a very long time. Be well, and I'll talk to you very soon. Oh, go ahead.
Thanks so much, and we will talk Tuesday.
To be continued. And thanks to everybody who joined us, whether you're listening live or on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And today, no time for a song. So take care.